Meanwhile, politicians like to talk about two Americas or two types of Americans, and most of the time it's people who live in urban centers and big cities who tend to have slightly different values than the rest of the country. But our next guest says that cities, their cavernous streets, their elegant skyscrapers, their bustling residents, are nothing less than our species' greatest invention. Edward Glaser is a professor of economics at Harvard, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and author of Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
And New York City has perhaps the most famous skyline on the entire planet, and it's probably thanks to our skyscrapers is not entirely thanks to our skyscrapers, but partly that iconic skyline that people know New York as much as they do, whether or not they've ever been here. Do you think New York is the ideal city?
No, I don't think there's any one ideal city, but I certainly think New York is an amazing city. I grew up in New York, and it shaped much of who I am, and I always get a thrill whenever I see that skyline and come towards the city.
As an economist, you're looking at cities through the lens of numbers and statistics, dollars and cents. What do skyscrapers mean for quality of life? They get knocked quite a bit by people who live here, as you know.
Skyscrapers mean space. They mean affordability. They mean the possibility of including more people in the city. When you have a place that's as exciting, as dynamic as New York City, people want to live there. And if you don't build, the place becomes an unaffordable boutique city that's, you know, available only to those people of enormous amounts of wealth. Delivering new units, as New York once did, remember in the early 1920s we used to build 100,000 new units a year. That kept the city affordable. That enabled hundreds of thousands of new people to come to New York and experience the remarkable promise of that city. But today it's much more difficult, and we need to build to make the city more affordable.
In the Bloomberg years, we have built and built and built, and until the bubble burst, prices for homes were still going up and up and up.
It's often hard for supply to catch up with demand, especially given that we went through so many decades of not building, right? We actually, from the 1950s through the 1990s, there was decline. And certainly I give Mayor Bloomberg great credit for pushing in the opposite direction. But there's still a lot of work to be done.
If you call cities our greatest invention, how do you see suburbs?
They're a way for people to combine, often working in a city and living among greenery. And, you know, it's in many cases, it's a lot better to have half of a city than none of a city.
In a way, in New York, we effectively have two cities. We have the dense high-rises of Manhattan and a few neighborhoods that are right in close in the boroughs. And then we have the lower, more spread-out neighborhoods around the other four boroughs, and now there's development in those other boroughs as well, and some refer to Brooklyn as the new Manhattan. Would it be best, in your opinion, if the landscape of Manhattan did spread deeper into the other boroughs?
I think a lot of what I call for is just an easing of regulations. It's not as if I know exactly what the market should be doing everywhere. I do think that it's natural that a lot of Manhattan can actually get taller, and that's a very natural way to do things. But certainly, lots of areas of the Brooklyn waterfront or the Queens waterfront, more height can be put there and more affordable housing can be produced there.
Jane Jacobs thought that preserving older, shorter buildings would keep prices affordable. Obviously, you come down on the other side of that historic urbanist.
It's very strange. I mean, I couldn't be a bigger fan of Jane Jacobs, and so much of what's in the book derives from the insights that she had from walking around cities. But sometimes ground-level insights steer you wrong, and what she saw was that old buildings were cheap and new buildings were expensive, hence that logically called her to say, well, let's stop allowing new buildings and keep buildings old. Well, that's not how supply and demand works, right? You've got to actually build more supply if you want to keep prices down. And I think this is one of the few areas in which she actually really made a mistake, and that New York would be healthier if it had more construction.
Were you a Robert Moses fan?
You know, I feel most comfortable with new building when it's actually free and doesn't involve huge amounts of eminent domain as well. So, but certainly Moses did a lot of good things, although he also did harm as well.
Cities have a reputation for being unhealthy, heavily polluted, covered in smog, often dirty, which we can see this week with the snow melting, the garbage underneath. Does it need to be that way?
Density has downsides as well as enormous benefits, and cities have been fighting for millennia with the challenges created by proximity, with the fact that if I'm close enough to sells you something or exchange an idea with you, I'm close enough to give you a disease. And this required big government interventions like the Croton Aqueduct, a massive government intervention in New York, which brought clean water to the city. Cities in this country were spending more on water than the federal government was spending on anything except for the army and the post office at the start of the 20th century. This was a huge intervention. But the impact of interventions like that and the huge safety interventions that occurred during the Giuliani years means that New York is now incredibly healthy. And we've gone from a situation where 110 years ago a boy born in New York could expect to live 7 years less than the national average to a world in which male life expectancy is almost 2 years higher in New York than in the rest of the nation.
You're with the conservative think tank, the Manhattan Institute. There's enough conservative rhetoric out in the land that's explicitly anti-city, where people would say, I come from good country values, and it's really a knock at the liberals who come from New York City into Congress and things like that. Is there a conservative cheerleading of cities that's different from a liberal cheerleading of cities?
Well, I think the conservative cheerleading of cities celebrates the competition and innovation and entrepreneurship that is so evident in urban areas. I think that's what one would hope to celebrate on that. I mean, the great tragedy of cities being particularly associated with one party is that it's one of the reasons why I think they get neglected, why they get maltreated by the federal government. I think actually healthy competition of both parties for city votes would be a heck of a lot healthier for cities, and we could move hopefully away from a situation in which we have policies that act as if the only American dream is living in a white picket fence in the suburb, because there's nothing un-American about living in an urban apartment.
Does that mean there is a conservative urbanism that is either waiting to be born or is too unrecognized by voters?
I certainly hope so. But the book isn't particularly conservative or liberal, right? The book is a celebration of cities, and there are lots of things that liberals get right as well as things that conservatives get right. I think actually the most promising thing about cities, and I'm just struck by these events in Cairo, is their incredible ability to bring change in the poorest parts of the world. It's been called the Facebook revolution, and it's absolutely true that these new technologies have played a critical role. But change wouldn't be happening if there weren't mobs on the streets of Cairo. And it makes a basic point that new technologies are not eviscerating cities. They actually put cities on steroids. They actually make cities more, not less important. And you see this both in the U.S. and in the developing world.
The triumph of the city, how our greatest invention makes us richer, smarter, greener, healthier, and happier. Edward Glaser is the author. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, listeners, if you haven't heard the news yet, military and ruling party officials in Egypt say President Hosni Mubarak will meet protesters' demands. NBC News is reporting that Mubarak will step down, perhaps momentarily, and that the vice president he appointed recently, Suleiman, will take over. We don't know if that's going to satisfy the protesters in the street. We will cover the unfolding situation in Egypt. This could be it for Hosni Mubarak, perhaps imminently, and we'll stay on it. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.